2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 212, My Mormon Mother Finally Tells Her Story, a paper presented by Gary Stewart with a response by Levi S. Peterson.
Hi, I'm Stacey Burton, and I'm glad to welcome you to Session 212, which is My Mormon Mother Finally Tells Her Story. Our speaker today, our presenter, is Gary Stewart, who recently retired after many years of teaching theater in Massachusetts and Indiana, who's written plays and many novels. He's now working on a memoir and on a novel. And his topic today, My Mormon Mother Finally Tells Her Story.
Let me set a scene for you. It's early May 1982. My wife Diana has just been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. A few days after the diagnosis, my mother calls Diana and without so much as a friendly greeting, tells her the grisly story of her friend Ray McFarland's slow agonizing death from multiple sclerosis many years before. My wife was a very strong woman, but this, of course, upsets her terribly. My mother calls again twice within the next few days and again relates various details of her friend's terrible demise. I finally have to call my mother and tell her she's not to try and talk to Diana for the rest of the summer. Another scene. It's a hot late July evening in 1980. We're at my Aunt Myra's small post-war bungalow in Bountiful. She's my father's brother's widow. It's a day or so after my father, my mother, my sister, and my sister's five kids arrived from Mesa, Arizona, where my parents lived. They're on vacation. Mother's been on a tear for days, attacking everyone, often to their face. Aunt Myra and my mother are in the kitchen doing the dishes. Mother's going on and on with verbal attacks on her seven-year-old granddaughter, Jenny. I just don't like her. She's a worthless child. Finally, Aunt Myra just has to say something. She tells Mother that however she feels about Jenny, she mustn't say anything in the child's presence. My mother is enraged, literally enraged. She shouts at my Aunt Myra, "Myra, you of all people trying to tell me what to do." And Mother has just started. She spits venom. Aunt Myra's afraid Mother's going to physically assault her. My father's up out of his chair, getting between my mother and his sister-in-law, trying to get my mother to calm down. Finally, my mother turns on my dad and shouts, "I made a mistake. I should have married Wayne." Now, Wayne is a young man who was on his mission when my father married my mother almost 48 years earlier. She has never stopped talking about him. The next day, my father has a massive heart attack. Aunt Myra drives him to the hospital because Mother's out shopping. 12 days later, he is dead. These are but two examples of the way my mother behaved in the last few years of her life. What happened? Where did all the anger and cruelty come from? I've thought a lot about Mother since her death, trying to figure out how and why she became this rather terrifying teller of whatever truth came to her mind. She seemed not to care who she hurt. This part of my mother's life was very painful to me. It wasn't as if she'd always been like this. When I was growing up, she was this great mother. I felt I could talk to her about anything. She told me repeatedly how much she loved me and made me believe I could accomplish anything I decided in my life. She was warm and welcoming and tolerant and funny. She had a sharp tongue even then, but I never felt it directed at me, and she kept it under control most of the time. My relationship with my mother was strained from the early 70s. Perpetual admonitions about the church and her palpable disappointment that I didn't become a general authority were on me to the point where we rarely shared a warm moment. I keep fighting this thing. Any show of affection on my part, any opening, led to exhortations for me to come back to feeling the same as she did about the church. Mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer early in 1984. She seemed to face the inevitability of her death stoically. My sister moved her back to Washington, D.C. to live out the final months with her family. Things got bad fast, as mother laid verbal waste to my sister and most of her family. Within a few months, my sister had to move mother away from her family to a small apartment of her own. Another aspect of mother's years after dad died was her intense fear. Fear that my father wouldn't want her in the hereafter. She wrote in letters to Diana and me, "You know, life has been quite unbearable for me. I look forward, often in tears, for it is difficult for me to have full faith that my very beautiful husband, beautiful inside and out, who has had only loving concern for me throughout our life together, will want me to share his glory. And life just isn't any bowl of cherries. Sometimes, but as the Lord told Joseph Smith in the jail, all of us will be of little moment in comparison to what we may attain through keeping the commandments of our Father in heaven and wait living forever in his presence. It is difficult to have full faith, even for me, in wondering if Dad will be waiting for the little kid he loved at first sight and knew was his mate. Mom said to my sister not long before she died, Dad will be happy to see you, and he'll be happy to see Gary, but not so happy to see me. Such pain in this woman who spent 48 years with my father and who was still taking her into the bedroom when he was 75 for afternoon sex. A few months after she moved east, mother was talking to my wife, Diana, complaining she had little to do in her life but wait for her death. Diana, in a brilliant stroke, suggested to mother that she might take the time to write her memoirs. That struck a spark, and mother immediately got out her typewriter and started pouring out page after page of topically arranged accounts of her life. Every couple of weeks, she'd send copies of what she wrote to Diana and me. It kept her occupied for several months. After she finished, she determined to print it up and send copies to almost everybody she knew, mostly family. My sister and I guided her through the editing process and made strong suggestions, which she mostly took, about what to include and what to exclude. Still, even the edited portions caused rifts in her family that will probably never be healed. My first attempt to make sense out of my mother's life was in 1991, when I put together an hour presentation of excerpts from her memoirs with my commentary. I had some 200 slides made of pictures of her, probably from birth to death. I edited her writings and had my two daughters, both of whom were in school in my department at the time, read from her material while I narrated, introduced the pictures, and offered my own commentary on what she wrote. But still, she haunted me. Finally, I had to attempt some explanation of the painful arc of her life to satisfy myself, if nothing else. I had what she wrote. I had my sister to bounce what I wrote off, and I had my Aunt Myra, who had known my mother most of her life. When I went back early this summer to her memoirs, I read them with growing unease. Somehow, with the 1991 presentation, I'd felt she'd given a pretty complete and honest, if fitful, account of her life. As I look back, I realize most of the coherence was a result of my editing and of my interest in presenting a coherent portrait. As I read them now, it slowly dawned on me that there was no coherent story presented there, no consistent sense of how she developed through her life. Her memoirs are rather an almost random assortment of stream of consciousness verbal vignettes. So I focused on what she reveals in her writing that might point to her underlying obsessions. If I couldn't present a convincing text of her life, there were all sorts of revealing things in her writing and behavior that pointed to a number of subtexts. The first thing I want to read are her comments about Wayne, the man she threw in my father's face at the end of his life. "I was very much in love with Wayne Reese. He was attending the University of Utah. Wayne and I had our usual Sunday date, and we took lovely rides up the various canyons and enjoyed one another. Sometimes we would be naughty and go to a show and just hold hands. But he was no Romeo, and there was little petting or loving. He was not a great lover, and I might have appreciated him more if he had been. I would have given anything to have Wayne grab me in a great embrace and plenty of kisses and tell me he would love me forever, which I believe he did. He did say he hoped I would be as clean and virtuous with every man as I was with him. Well, who had an opportunity to be otherwise? Yes, really. A common bond my parents shared was that each left a life of borderline poverty in southern Utah. in their mid-teens, and they ended up in Salt Lake. Dad left at 14 to work in the mines in Eureka. He'd barely finished the eighth grade. Mother again. A spokeswoman for a group of my friends said, "Vera, why would a girl with not only your beauty and attractiveness, but your talents, choose to go with a clod like this Stewart?" Mother called my father Vera. "You could have Lad Irvine, pre-med returned missionary from Germany, several other prominent boys in the world at stake, or Richard Bennett of the Bennett Oil and Money. You could be choosy." I didn't wholeheartedly love Vera when I married him. My missionary that I loved so completely for a couple of years was on a mission, and I had told him I would take up where we left off, but would date. Dad was asked to go on a 6-month mission in southern Utah before we were married, which would have made it just fine, but he refused to go and also refused to wait until Wayne returned. We would have been happier and much better off had we waited, for a lot of my nerve trouble stemmed from this lack of feeling. Mother clearly could never let this go. When she talked about Wayne with me or my sister, it was as if all this happened yesterday, not over 40 years ago. This gives a clue to one thing the matter with my mother. She never saw her life as a process of discovery into which she could incorporate past memories, successes, and failures into a coherent story of her life. Events from 40 years ago had the force and immediacy of whatever happened yesterday. Certainly one of the most vivid and revealing and sustained segments Mother wrote was an account of her childhood. "I was born as the ninth child to John Towney and Mirza Jane Whitehead Miles on the 8th day of November 1909 in my mother's beloved town of St. George, Utah. Samuel Miles, my grandfather, was an 18-year-old member of the Mormon Battalion, having been taught to be a school teacher and being called to help with the settling of St. George. He died an educator with always the wish to be obedient to any assignment given to him by Brigham Young. My mother was a child of polygamy and had no full brothers and sisters because my beautiful and sensitive grandmother, Mercy Jane Alexander, was unable to live this law and divorced grandfather Adolphus Rennie Whitehead. She felt trapped because of jealousy and hate from the first wife, who cut off mother's curls and threw them in the fire. Mother, in trying to get them, set fire to her head. When my mother's father died, she received an inheritance, which she used as a down payment on our farm, 17 miles north of St. George by the volcanoes in what was called, we called Diamond Valley. My mother was called upon to sew, take in washing, or anything else to earn a little money to keep our home going. No money, but mother spent every available moment canning and preparing meat and bottled fruit for the following winter. The sheep herders often gave us little Dougie lambs, and we raised them to maturity to use on our table. I remember slaughter day for the pigs. They were killed and doused up and down in a barrel of scalding water to help remove the hair. Mother spent her spare moments digging a trench in order to bring spring water to our ranch. She started charging 5 cents on every head of livestock, drinking at our large trough in front of our home, and met the mortgage payments through this. She paid her tithing while her children went hungry sometimes. Mother never rocked. She ran or trotted to town. After marriage, my husband commented that he wasn't exactly enamored of all my family of brothers and sisters, but he felt that had my mother lived in our time, that she could have been a real estate tycoon. And there was my bout with diphtheria when I was 6. My little sister Esther came down with it. Her breathing was labored, and I doubt if mother, because of her severe hearing loss, could really hear how bad she really was until it was too late. 4 days later, my father got the covered wagon ready with fire in the stove, and mother and Esther and I started for St. George, 17 miles away in a half-day trip. Esther died just after the doctor administered the antitoxin. Mother and I were doomed, but our illness was lessened by the antitoxin, and we both survived after quite a siege of it. At 13, I had the dreaded rheumatic fever. I remember lying awake all night long and watching the clock every few minutes to see if morning would ever come. Mornings only brought much activity for the small children, and it was agony when they bounced a ball on the wooden floors. It affected my nervous system and was most disastrous, to the point mother called the family home for a funeral. My father was a natural farmer, having learned from his father and eight brothers, and so we had lovely gardens of corn, alfalfa, Bartlett pears, raspberry bushes. While helping my father, while haying, my father slipped and fell on a pitchfork, which pierced his spine and laid him up most of his life and caused untold nervous reactions and troubles. He was a broken-hearted man, sick in his mind and so sad. Dad died from flu at age 56 in the big epidemic during the war. He died while I was in bed with him with the same trouble because of lack of beds. I was 10 years old when my father died and only 11 when mother remarried. I was upset, for I was thrown to the wolves, so to speak. Mother had a new playfellow, Josiah Henry Levitt. Uncle Cy was a big, jolly, friendly, fine-looking man, full of jokes and fun, quite the antithesis of my father. She really loved him and spent a good deal of time trying to get Bertha and me to call him Pa. Some of the children called Mother Ma. Well, I sat on a horse, some of his children called my mother Ma. Well, I sat on a horse for well over half an hour one day trying to call him out by the name I called my, call him by the name I called my father just over a year before. I couldn't utter the name. It was sacred to me. I just wanted him to unsaddle the horse and lift me off. Uncle Cy's children dragged a family of 17 to our 10. They loved to twit us about having a very small family compared to theirs. Finally, I had to set them straight. I told them that apparently their mother went in for quantity while ours went in for quality. That really went over big, and they disliked me even more for my quick tongue. Uncle Cy had lied to Mother about his dwelling. He had told her it was nice and papered, but it had many spaces between green boards and was papered with a Sears Roebuck catalog. We had to haul water for drinking and take the cows to water miles away and milk them night and morning. I often milked three cows and manure up to my ankles. Uncle Cy's children, nine at home in all, had no shoes, so Mother insisted we go barefoot too. By the end of the summer, I could walk over burrs and never feel a thing. I ran down through the oak brush one day and a rattlesnake slithered under my feet. My stepbrothers killed it and it had 15 rattles on it. I lived in mortal terror of stepping on one while herding cows to the water several miles distant. I truly believe some of my later nervous trouble could be attributed to the horror of snakes all that summer and feeling my way to avoid them. Uncle Cy loved my mother but didn't seem to have any talent for earning a buck. My sisters wanted Mother to kick him out later in life because he did no work. He did get hold of our farm through hook or crook so he could turn it over to his elder son. The farm was a shambles by then and never regained its former glory. It was my college money. When she was barely in her teens, Mother was farmed out to a series of families to work as something of an indentured servant to them. That winter, I was parceled out to my oldest sister with a large family to help with the milking. It was as though I had been thrown to the wolves. Then I was given over to a nice family for the pay of $1 a week. I did have lovely food, and they were nice to me. She had four children with one coming, and I did a great deal of the work. I retired for a 13-year-old. Mother came and knocked my window one early morning that summer, and I cried to go with her. She attempted to make me quiet down, but I cried until she took me with her. Uncle Cy insisted I be taken to the farm and that she get a bottle of Nervine. It turns out Mother had the rheumatic fever that damaged her heart. In her mid-teens, Mother moved to Salt Lake to go to school at West High and stay with her brother Jack and his wife and four children. In her telling, she became responsible for the children as well as the cleaning and other household chores. Quote, "The winters were wearisome since I was not permitted to stay after school for any extracurricular activities. It was very difficult to keep everything up, washing dishes and the whole bit, and still find time to study. I usually found myself at my studies after 10:30, getting up in the night to feed the babe and up at 6 to start the fire for the day." What struck me this reading was the struggle my mother had as a child for any kind of individual identity. The family had no social standing, they were dirt poor, and Mother, as the youngest, had no real standing in the family. One of 27 children from the time she was 11, in the sense of being, for her teenage years, essentially a household servant. Another part of the story central to her life and about which she wrote vividly are her bouts with mental illness. Just before Gary was 3 years old, I had a crazy bout of being upset and thinking wild things which landed me in the LDS hospital. When I was released and taken to a private home where someone attended me regularly and tried to get me to eat, I had no appetite, and I suppose Dad was beside himself as to know what to do. Finally, they took the last resort and took me to the state hospital in Provo. I try to believe my rough treatment at the mental hospital was due in part to the current belief that new patients were due to stay, for they had no tranquilizers or other like medication to help. I was treated like an animal. They insisted on my answering questions and let me stay in a room by myself until I answered, and often used bright lights to shine directly into my eyes. I never explained to my ophthalmologist the reason when he mentioned that for some reason my retina had been damaged. I didn't have an appetite, and I was threatened constantly that they would tube feed me if I didn't eat. I shuddered at the thought of either alternative, for they had sent me to the kitchen to help clean chickens and cut them up, and let me tell you under oath if necessary, the chickens I was told to clean, help clean, were spoiled rotten. It was worse than a prison. When I became a little rebellious, I was shoved into a cell and thrown a banana or something and had a potty in the corner. I don't know how long this went on, but I found myself back in a bed with a nasty little attendant trying to get me to urinate. I had just done that little thing recently and was unable to produce. She stood over me and hollered, "Pee, damn you, pee." I could hear Sister Piper's counsel. This was a woman she boarded with after high school. I could hear Sister Piper's counsel ringing in my ears that I would be among the weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth for rushing on Sunday and walking up to their home 2 miles. I thought how right she was and felt condemned. Then one morning it seemed I had just something like a vision. I was given the feeling that I must do what is right and always do it. I ran from the room and grabbed a chair which I felt was the judgment seat and kept on the right side. One of the nurses later jokingly said that little Vera wouldn't be put even her left shoe on first, only the right. Then it was decided to give me some insulin shock treatment. The evil nurse seemed to take joy in shoving a needle in. I'd received so much then I had become a little hardened to it. The effect of this treatment turned out all right. They would give you the shot, then you lay there with other patients until it took effect. Vera danced attendance when they released me and let me go home. During this attack, I was sent to just before my third birthday to live with my Aunt Myra and Uncle Rand in Tooele. I was there 3 months. I lived with them 2 more extended periods subsequently while Mother was in the state mental hospital. She never forgave Aunt Myra for caring for me those times. Shortly before she died, Mother admitted to my aunt that she'd always been angry and jealous of her. A year or so before she died, Mother said to her sister-in-law, "You know, Myra, I think I could learn to like you." Mother had these breakdowns on a regular basis for the rest of her life. About every 5 years, she would enter a manic phase, feeling superhuman, in control of her life, invulnerable. This phase would be followed by several days of caving back in on herself. She would get overcome by religious feelings accompanied by strong feelings of guilt. I remember her sitting on our living room floor, obsessively poring over a child's book of stories of Jesus. During this period, she would shout at other people almost entirely. The final stage of the breakdown resulted in explosive behavior that apparently related not at all to her everyday life. When I was 16, I remember being awakened by screaming from my parents' bedroom at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was my mother shouting every obscenity, profanity, and vulgarism I'd ever heard, and a good many I hadn't heard, doing this within an intense energy field no one could enter easily. After several minutes of this, my father called a doctor friend. By the time the doctor arrived, Mother had set fire to all her clothes in the closet and ripped to pieces my father's library of church books. It took 2 strong men and a syringe of strong narcotics to quiet her down. By morning, she was subdued to a point where she was totally inert. I remember driving to the Provo Mental Hospital with her in the front seat between my father and me. She was clutching the knob from a plastic radio my parents had in their bedroom. After about 3 months, she was back home and apparently quite normal. Between trips to the hospital, Mother saw a psychiatrist. but I never had the sense that he was conducting serious therapy sessions with her. Mormons were very distrustful of any confidence revealed to anyone outside the family or church leaders. What the doctor did do was prescribe a heavy regimen of pills, uppers and downers mostly, meant to get her through the day and painlessly into the night. The doctor seemed not to be aware of the new antidepressants developed in the late 50s and early 60s. And she wasn't prescribed lithium until 1974, when a doctor in Riverside, California saw her condition and acted appropriately. But it was apparently too late. Though she felt better for a time, her attacks on loved ones and complete stranger only accelerated throughout the late 70s. One thing that came clear through these stories is the horrible guilt that underlay these illnesses, and that had to be a significant force in her whole life. A primary source of my mother's lifelong battle with guilt had to do with her children, or lack of them, both the ones she raised, my sister and me, and the ones she lost. I wasn't born until I'd been married 5 years. Mother, I really felt guilty not having a child, but being a child among six sisters, having travail and all the problems and upsets of pregnancies, I became very apprehensive of even trying to have a babe. I was very frightened and cried in my soup a lot when Vero came home for lunch. But we came home from a dance once, and I told him this was it. I couldn't face the guilt of not having a baby after 4 years. We jumped right into bed. Right after, I leapt up from the bed crying that I was pregnant. I got that darling Gary with just one try. My first miscarriage happened in 1942, when I was between 2 and 3 months. And little 5-year-old Gary got the mumps. I called Dr. Horn in alarm, and he told me to relax. He'd never had a woman with the mumps. On arising the next morning, my cheeks were fatter than a chipmunk, and in alarm, I again made a call. I was told to relax, and he would see me that afternoon. I got some bad pains and finally got only Vero's cousin, Orlena. When the little one came, she scurried into the bathroom and flushed it down. In 1945, I had a near-death experience and prediction of my death after a blood clot lodged in and inflamed the vein of my main artery. One morning, before my husband had arrived, Dr. Horn called upon the Lord and blessed me as though he were talking to God himself in person, saying, "If this woman is to have this child, cleanse her body and blood." He instructed the intern when he called the next morning and learned labor had set in to give me a certain shot. Through error, I was given one to hold labor rather than to encourage it, resulting in a vast collection of large blood clots in my abdomen and uterus, which caused untold agony. Dr. Taylor, our family doctor and close friend of Dr. Horn, entered my room and exclaimed that this was the answer to their prayers. I told him grimly that this was really something to be the answer to anyone's prayer. In 1947, I became pregnant for the fifth time against the directions of my beloved Dr. Horn. When I was about or past midway of my pregnancy, I was taken to a hospital and the staff wanted to abort my baby. Dr. Horn fought them and refused to let me submit to that to save my life, holding out for a natural coming of the baby by natural labor, and it turned out to be a terrifying travail. My doctor thinks I shall have the privilege of raising at least two of the three children I lost in the hereafter. One day when Susie's my sister, one day when Susie was a little girl, she was counting our family and came up with Mommy and Daddy, Gary and Susanna, Baby Ruth and John David, and, oh yes, little what's-his name who got flushed down the toilet. My mother should have had at least 7 or 8 children. She had that much energy and capacity. In lieu of that, she made the mistake of focusing all her strong will on the two children she did have. From the time I was born, my mother obsessed over me. I was quite a sickly child who was blind as a bat. She hovered over me, charging out to fight my battles for me. She was the source of much of the strength I had as I grew up. I did feel protected. And I used to call her well into my marriage with problems I had, mostly mental problems, matters I knew she knew something about. But her protective cover started to become oppressive as I approached my mid-20s, and as I pulled away, she became resentful, at first aimed at me, later at my wife. After I asked Mother not to talk to Diana for a time, she wrote Diana a letter in which she bore her testimony of the truth of the church several times over and morphed the letter to address me directly. The glories of the temple should be yours, Gary. I guess my great moment will be to walk down the aisle of the temple holding my son's hand with his eyes lit up with the joy of being there. Later in life, Mother told Diana that I've always had a special place in my heart for my brilliant and beautiful son. I've always given him the best, the hostess cupcake with the white frosting, for example, leaving Vera with the brown. As she said to Diana by way of summing up, it's the Oedipal thing, you know. The picture of me Mother kept most prominent in her later years was a colorized portrait of me when I was 5. I think this is how she saw me until the day she died. The church was the assumed center of my mother's life. She defined her action by what she perceived were church standards. Inasmuch as she developed a personal story, it was dictated by her understanding of what was required by the church. Following are some excerpts from her writing that deal directly with her beliefs and feelings about the church. One day a young Catholic boy said to me that some big shot in our church had called his church the Great and Abominable Church. I told him the book had been recalled. I added that he wasn't so far from wrong, since anything that wasn't the whole truth was an abomination in the sight of God, and added that I was afraid his church did not have the whole truth. And there were resentments that crept into her accounts of her place in the church. I never had but one real leadership position in the church. I was Gleaner Girls' leader. This was before they realized in the various wards and stakes in Kaysville that Jules Earl Stewart should be put in charge of most everything available, and that his so-called better half should remain and keep the home fires burning and attend strictly to household duties aside from minor positions, caring for his needs when and if required. One night in church, someone told the audience he had had a dream the night before. Sister Stewart, Bishop Stewart's wife, was chasing butterflies on horseback. I told him I did catch butterflies and I did ride horses, but not simultaneously. Then I added that the people in Kaysville already knew I was off my rocker, and he was adding to the rumors. There was a time my sister and I hoped maybe Mother would take over her life. It started just a few days after my father died. Dad died on August 12, 1980. A few days after his death, while my sister and I made funeral and burial arrangements, my mother was pretty much a walking ghost, lost in her own grief and pain. From time to time that week, something of the old Vera did break through. For example, when my sister Susie and I were negotiating our way through the price list for a funeral casket vault complex with this unctuous undertaker, Mother just sat back until Mr. Nalder tried to sell us a $1,000 vault. The material was engineered for the nose cone of the space shuttle. It'll keep water out for 1,000 years. That was apparently enough for my mother, as she asked, disbelieving, "It'll keep water out for 1,000 years? Yes, ma'am. Well, where exactly is he going to swim to?" And my sister and I drove Mother back to Mesa, Arizona, where she lived. She seemed to come alive, and for 2 or 3 days she was the mother we'd known growing up. Alert, energetic, curious. She insisted we visit the old stone house where she'd grown up north of St. George. We visited relatives, her nieces and nephews in St. George. And on a Sunday morning, she pushed us to stop in Colorado City so she could visit her niece. The somewhat shocked niece, who was in the middle of Sunday service provided over by her husband at a long table in their living room, tolerated us at the front door for a few minutes while other wives and dozens of children scattered into rooms in various parts of the house. But within a couple of months, she started in on her loved ones again, and she played the lonely old widow with little besides her weekly temple work to keep boredom and fear away. When we're old, if we're fortunate, our life makes some sort of linear sense. We have a story that constantly points to a sense of who we are. There are all sorts of possible reasons my mother was never reflective enough to be able to weave the various strands of her life into a whole pattern. The most obvious is that she was just too mentally disturbed to do so. Her struggle with mental illness was so great, so intense, that she wasn't able to back away from that struggle to get some perspective. I've often thought that by the time she was 65, her brain was pretty much fried from all the drugs and all the fear and guilt and from all the terrible things she perceived people did to her. I think by the end she came to think of her life as a series of betrayals. First, her dad betrayed her by dying. Her mother betrayed her by giving herself completely to her second husband. She felt betrayed by her siblings, especially her brother Jack. She felt betrayed by my father for not letting her wait for her missionary. And it's clear from her accounts, despite all the protestations, that she felt her doctors betrayed her. One of her big betrayals was my defection, my needing to build my own emotional life in relation to my wife. I also think she felt betrayed by her church, which didn't provide her an opportunity to expand her gifts. The final betrayal, and the one she feared most, was the possible rejection by her husband in the hereafter. Whatever the causes, my mother lived in a series of situations that could not contain her life. She was born into a culture that valued men above women, a culture that distrusted anyone with mental problems, and she was loyal to a church that could not meet her needs, a church that seemed to fear smart, outspoken, difficult women. She could somehow never allow herself to become an adult. A poet friend of mine who has seen many dark days said she vowed early to always live in the sunlight. I think my Aunt Myra lives mostly in the sunlight. My sister lives in the sun. My wife, even through terrible physical trials, lived in the sunlight. But some of us just can't live our lives always or even mostly in the sunlight. We crave the dark, seek out the dark, and it feeds us as much as the sunlight feeds others. Mother desperately wanted to live in the sunlight. She thought God and her church wanted her to live in the sunlight. But that didn't work for her. I think she needed to seek the dark, understand the darkness in her life, become absorbed in it. At least she needed some ability to look at herself objectively as well as subjectively, a sense of irony, perhaps. Maybe she should have been an artist, a writer. She was very bright and had a gift for words. Writing could have been a powerful and effective medium through which she could understand her demons and perhaps to conquer them.
Thank you very much for that very moving presentation. Our respondent today is Levi Peterson, who is a retired professor of English from Weber State, the author of collections of short stories, novels, and a biography, who's now been appointed associate editor of Dialogue.
I'm happy to meet Gary Stewart in person. I've read his writings, and he's a strong writer on Mormon themes as well as others. I recall in his novel, The Tenth Virgin, he speaks of those, quote, this is a near quote, those tough old birds who inhabit the church office building, as he characterized in that mystery novel, there was some bad egg among the brethren, as I recall in that novel, Gary. Bird. It's very absorbing, compelling personal essay that we have just heard, truly of compelling interest. There's an admirable candor to it. And I will say that candor is a quality much lacking in that popular Mormon genre that we call family history or family biography. I value that the impulse of the church to foster family biography and family history, but I deplore the lack of candor. There's a considerable need in family biography to create role models for the future generations. And so the virtues of worn out elderly persons are projected back onto the rather human and rascally young person about whom the biography is being written. And we see, well, basically something that's false, something that isn't true. So I respect very much the candor we've heard here. And I would say it's, I will agree, as Gary has said in his abstract, that it's a unique story. If you go into details, anyone's story is unique. And I would say that almost anyone's history becomes intensely interesting, anyone's life, if you tell it candidly, and if you get into the personal details. And I think Gary's fortunate here that his mother did write that rambling stream of consciousness document that he then can go back into and impose some rational order upon. Certainly a story that deserves to be told. I would turn to the perhaps crucial question, given the abstract that Gary published, in which he says that his mother, the anguish his mother suffered and imposed on others, was affected by her Mormonism. And given our setting here, the Sunstone setting, I think that's a good question to ask. What role did this woman's religion play in her anguish and the anguish of her family? Now, Gary says that it implies in the abstract that in the beginning, in the early years of her marriage, when he was a child, his mother was a very affectionate and supportive mother. I will say this by way of critique, if you intend to revise your document, that you would, I would say, to make more of that in your paper, that it would be good to let your readers have more detail on the ways in which your mother was a model mother and a good supportive mother. Because you did a very convincing job of showing her to be a social problem to herself and everyone else as she aged. An interesting question would be how, given the fact that when Gary was quite young, she was entering the mental hospital periodically, how did her good qualities as a mother interplay with those episodes? That would be a very interesting thing for Gary to develop and talk about. We come, I think, here to the question of the roots of insanity. Where does it come from? How does it happen to people? And what is the role of our institutions, our religion, or our larger cultural values? What role do those have in causing insanity? And I really don't suppose there's an answer that's definitive, no matter who gives it to you or how versed in psychiatry or psychology and so on. Insanity remains a deep mystery to all of us. I'm convinced that the roots of insanity are in all of us. And if we don't realize that, it's because we're lucky and circumstances haven't evoked that grim, lurking reality from the depths of our psyche. Certainly, we can say that insanity has genetic and environmental roots. Your genetic inheritance seems to have something to do with it. Your early social environment has a lot to do with it, but exactly how much, who knows, because one person in a family emerges from childhood suffering from insanity, the rest of the children don't. Why, who knows? But you recall that she went into the history of her own mother and father in rural Utah. And it wasn't nice, it wasn't pretty, things were pretty bad. Uncle Cy, Gary's mother's mother got attached to Uncle Cy Levitt. Was that his name, Gary? Yeah. Can't trust those Levitts. Which reminds me, incidentally, that they're of course, Juanita Brooks was a Levitt, whom I know because the biography that was mentioned is a biography of Juanita Brooks, originally a Levitt. But the sheer poverty and the grim reality of what the poverty does to children was very evident in this woman's life. And that certainly that could have contributed to her insanity. It would seem that the benighted medical and psychiatric practices of this woman's era might have had something to do with it. You'd like to think that modern psychiatric practices would have helped her back in that. It would seem that the treatment she received in the mental hospital would have exacerbated rather than helped her condition. And so it led finally to the question of how much did her religion affect her misery and the misery of those around her. And I don't know that Gary's built his case strongly enough, if he can indeed. Surely her Mormonism had something to do with it. He talks about her need for position. I would relate that to a very common expression on the part of women now. What shall we say, liberal Mormon women, a common expression for a desire for a share in the decision-making in the church, which seems to me to be a justifiable demand. I don't know how important of a matter that is. Gary didn't emphasize it much in his essay, in the details about his mother. I'm thinking of, it strikes me that the case to be made against our religion for its general treatment of women, it's a real case to be made. I'm not sure how much it applies to this woman, partly surely, but I'll talk a bit about that. It might be Gary's memory of his mother as a good mother when he was a child had something to do with the fact she had something to do that was purposeful. The children being raised, she no longer has anything that's purposeful. And that's a syndrome quite common to Mormon women in a culture that emphasizes motherhood, homemaking, child-rearing as the role of women, despite the fact that, as everyone knows now, the majority of Mormon women take on other careers, other roles, when they're particularly as their children start getting school age, becoming of school age. So dealing just a moment with the narrow limits that the Latter-day Saint faith imposes upon women, I'm thinking of a number of women I know well. Juanita Brooks, about whom I wrote a biography, combined the role of mother and rural housewife very nicely with a career as a professional historian. But you will recall the famous episode of Juanita keeping her typewriter and papers on the kitchen table, and when a neighbor knocked, quickly throwing a cover over the typewriter and the papers, and she would have her ironing board and the ironing standing nearby, and as she shouted, "Come in," she would be ironing something. And one neighbor even remarked, having come a second or third time during 1 week, "And my, you've been ironing all week, haven't you?" Well, she had to use deception to do that, but I will say this about Juanita. She was a fulfilled woman. I believe that, having studied her life. She succeeded. She managed it to be the mother, the housewife, and still have a fine professional career. I think of my own mother. a very different temperament and personality from Juanita Brooks. I think my mother was very fulfilled by being a mother and housewife, and fortunately and unfortunately, when I was 9, my father died, and my mother became also the breadwinner. She became a school teacher, and I was for the final 25 years of her active life, she taught school, and I was very fulfilling to her. And she had no problem with the church because everyone agreed, her husband being dead, and she had to earn a living. And so she could harmonize her religion with her career as an elementary school teacher, which she liked very much, nicely. She had no problem. My mother would have been the last person to grumble about the role of women in the church. Though she did tell me often that when she was a teenager, she thought about the favoritism shown to boys, and she envied boys, and it was only when she had her first child that she became satisfied with the role of women. Going on there, I think of many unfulfilled women among my closer relatives, women that I see as trapped in the role of mother and housewife, who don't have enough to do, and they don't have enough that meets their abilities to do, enough that's fulfilling. And I see a considerable restlessness in them, what might be hypochondria, the attempt to find fulfillment in occasional volunteer work. It seems to me the fact is that Mormonism, and this has been said over and over, this is old stuff, that the Mormonism is far behind American culture generally in freeing its women. Mormon patriarchy of today is American patriarchy of 30, 40, 50 years ago. It's clear and simple. It's nothing new. It just hasn't changed among the Mormons. And I agree that the freeing of the Mormon woman is one of the major thrusts of the effort to liberalize Mormonism. An uncertain business, and much is yet to be done, and I think you'll hear lots of presentations and papers here at Sunstone on this very topic, with good reason. Well, I don't know how much of all this would apply to Gary's mother. Because, as I say, there's this mix of her poverty. Who knows what genetics had to do with her distress and her anguish. Her religion had something to do with it, but I would say that on the basis of what we've heard, that it isn't a substantial cause. I think if Gary wants to make a case for it being a substantial cause, he should maybe become more emphatic with details, illustrative details along that line. Nonetheless, this kind of a story needs to be told. I think it needs to be told. It's a purgative for Gary to write it, if nothing else. And while I think we sit here hearing it, suffering and almost wishing we'd gone to another session, you see, it was such an anguished story, an anguishing story. No, that's the kind of thing you need to get out into the open, and you do need to say it happens to Mormon women, and it happens all the time. Who knows whether there's a higher percentage among Mormon women than other kinds of women, or among other kinds of men, for that matter. It's a human malady that we're dealing with here. But it needs to be told. We need to make a constant effort, movement toward candor, to militate against this compulsion among the Latter-day Saints that theirs is an ideal religion, and it gives you an ideal happiness, and if you aren't happy, there's something wrong with you. Thanks very much.
you very much. We have time for questions.
We're going through in our own family something very similar right now. And I received from my oldest sister a copy of what is to be the official family history. In fact, it came 2 weeks ago. And I wrote her back and said, this is not the mother I knew. I don't even know her. I received a telephone call from her saying, we don't want to bring up bad things. And when Gary was talking about the uppers and downers 50 years ago, this is what we went through. My mother, as we speak, has decided to go to a doctor in Medford, Oregon, about having heart surgery at the age of 85, which he has said, frankly, has a 30% chance of succeeding, and if it doesn't succeed, will either kill her or make her an invalid. Another sister will then have to look after her for the rest of what will be a miserable life if that happens. They asked my opinion. I said, for heaven's sake, why is she doing this? Because you're extending her life. Oh. Anyway, I rest my case, and I think that it's a story that does need to tell.
For the tape, it was a comment perhaps more than a question about receiving family stories and not recognizing your relatives in them when you see them and the dilemmas of that. Nadine? You talked a little bit about distancing yourself from your mother emotionally as you needed to transfer your devotion from your mother to your wife. Did also your feelings about the church distance you from your mother in some ways? For some reason I had that impression in reading the abstract, but I didn't really catch it in your talk.
It's a good question. I think that let me say this: in the early 70s, my mother decided that the way to get to me, because I had already shown significant alienation from certain aspects of the church anyway, she decided that my father should go on a trip with me and talk religion to me and get me straightened out. And we did go on a trip together, and he did, once in those 5 days, for 2 hours, deliver a very uncomfortable sermon about the church and about what I ought to do. What happened was that we became good friends and went on a lot of these trips and never once talked about the church again. And Mother grew to resent these trips with some vehemence, and my mother did. This is one of the toughest things I've ever done. And when I wrote the abstract, I really thought I had a nice, tight little account of my mother. And the more I got into it, the less I was able to. And I felt if I was going to be honest, I'd have to just try and work my way through it. If I had it all to do over again, I probably wouldn't. About revising it, I think I never want to see it again. It's been very tough, but very important. And I think a very important account to leave for my grandkids. My kids have only negative memories of Mother, and so anyway, that's.
Wondering that I think has been brought to our attention just lately with the women who have done away with their children is the fact that Gary's mother seemed to have problems with conceiving to begin with. I wonder if there has not been some medical problem with her in hormones or whatever, and I don't think that was touched on at all, and it's sounds like a little bit to me that there's a possibility of that. We also have a daughter-in-law who has experienced some problems, and she had problems conceiving to begin with, too. So I think that is one thing that might be considered in your mother's case.
Yeah, I think clearly it was some medical thing, which she and my father, the first 4 years of their marriage, lived, shall we say, a pretty high life in Salt Lake. My mother would, in moments of candor, would talk about their dancing at the Rainbow Rendezvous in the old mill, and mother getting drunk and singing with the band at the old mill. And one story she told about me was that the last drink she took was when they, the night they went dancing and then got home, carried me up the basement stairs and dropped me on my head. She said that's the last drink she ever took. But there was an enormous amount of guilt about this later in her life, which is too bad, because my father would never talk about such things. But it did open a kind of window on who they were and how they lived their lives, and that they weren't always this patriarch and his loony wife who lived out in Davis County.
We're at the end of our time, so we'll come to an end now, but thanks again very much to Gary Stewart and Levi Peterson.